So we come now to the last few days of Jesus' life. And Matthew will be following Mark's gospel very closely. Matthew 26, verse 1. When Jesus had finished saying all these things, a very common way of Matthew writing straight after one of the big discourses, he said to his disciples, "You know that after 2 days, the Passover is coming, and the Son of Man will be handed over to be crucified." The Passover that year, we know this from John's Gospel, and all the scholars agree that John has named a time accurately. According to John's Gospel, the beloved disciples' Gospel, the Passover this year was a very special one because it happened on the Sabbath. So it was the Saturday. And on the Friday, because their day began at sunset. So on what we'll call the Friday afternoon, that's when the lambs were slaughtered, ready for the ritual sacrifice. And then at 6 p.m. on what we'll call Friday, that is the beginning of the Sabbath, that was the solemn, sacred day that year. Jesus, as we'll see, wasn't alive to have this Passover meal. He died in the afternoon of the Friday while the lambs were being prepared. So he didn't have a Passover meal, technically. But he had a Last Supper with his disciples, and no doubt Jesus gave it. The Exodus, the Passover, because everyone's coming to the city for the Feast of Passover. So that's the environment, that's the kind of mood of the time. So Jesus gave it that meaning, and the disciples did too. And here we find Matthew couching this last meal, and by the way, there was no Passover lamb at it. That's not mentioned, so it's not actually a Passover meal, but in that Last Supper he will bring all the motifs of Exodus, escape from there, Passover meal, passing over from Egypt to the Promised Land, all of that. Matthew continues, "Then the chief priests and the elders of the people gathered in the palace of the high priest, who was called Caiaphas." Now, we know the history of this. Yes, Caiaphas was appointed by the Roman authorities, and his father-in-law, Annas, was sacked, and Rome had the power, so Caiaphas is the high priest. But many of the Jews kept venerating the older man as the real high priest, Annas. And they're talked about as high priest in different ways. So here we have the official Roman system whereby the high priest, that's Caiaphas, they conspired to arrest Jesus by stealth and kill him. But they said not during the festival, or there may be a riot among the people. And we're going to see they actually succeeded in that. He was killed on the Friday. The festival was the Sabbath day. And the mood is picked up here in a way. It's a strange scene. No one's named it, but we'll read it. While Jesus was at Bethany in the house of Simon the leper — we don't know about that man from anywhere else — a woman, she's unnamed, came to Jesus with an alabaster jar of very costly ointment. The Greek, which you'll see there, is myron. This is myrrh, very expensive ointment. And she poured it on his head. as he sat at table. There are a number of scenes of women anointing Jesus. Some of them anoints the feet, and one of them, this one really, in John's Gospel, is named Mary. Mary of Bethany. And it's Lazarus's house they're in, so it's all very... The story must have come down in different ways and was remembered by people in different ways in the traditions. So here we have Matthew's general account of it. When the disciples saw this, they were angry. And they said, why this waste, this ointment, this anointing oil, could have been sold for a large sum and the money given to the poor. Well, that's good. They're learning the lesson. That's pretty sensible. But Jesus, aware of this, said to them, why do you trouble the woman? She's performed a good service for me. You always have the poor. You won't always have me. By pouring this ointment on my body, she has prepared me for burial. So we're getting ready. The scene is getting us ready. In John's Gospel, again, the same thing, but it's a woman called Mary. Not Mary of Magdala, but Mary of Bethany is named there. And it's about Jesus in John, the scent, the perfume of the anointing, when he says goes through the whole house. If you're watching this staged, you're meant to, the perfume of this anointing is meant to take you right through to the resurrection. That's the perfume of this, these events. Truly I tell you, says Jesus, whatever the good news is proclaimed in the whole world, what she has done will be told in remembrance of her. And here's Matthew remembering her, but we don't know in Matthew who it is. So it's meant to be any of us, really. Then one of the 12, who was called Judas Iscariot. Iscariot is a bit difficult. It might be a place, but also in Aramaic, Iscariot means the betrayer. So it's quite likely this is the name that's hooked onto him, like Simon has Peter put on him, the rock on which the church is built. So Judas, whatever his actual family name, is called Iscariot. I think that's very likely, the betrayer. He went to the chief priests and said, what will you give me if I deliver him up to you? I put the Greek there because it will become relevant soon. Paradidomi in Greek means give. So paradidomi means to give over. It's actually sometimes translated betray. And that's not impossible, but it's strange because that's every other use of the word paradidomi in the gospel means to offer over, to give over. So I've kept that translation here. They paid him 30 pieces of silver. And from that moment, Judas began to look for an opportunity to deliver him up, to hand him over. There's a couple of texts behind that 30 pieces of silver. One is Zechariah chapter 11, and the other is Exodus 21. I said to them, if it seems right to you, give me my wages. This is the prophet speaking. But if not, well, keep them. So they weighed out as my wages 30 shekels. of silver, which was meant to mean a very poor, like he's not worth much if that's all you can offer for him. Then Yahweh said to me, well, throw it into the sanctuary. It's this lordly price at which I was valued by them. That's all God is worth. The prophet is God. So if everything I'm saying to you is only worth that much, we'll throw it back and give it back to them. So he threw them in the treasury of the house of Yahweh. 30 pieces of silver is the price given for a slave, a worthless person, really. And here's the Exodus text. If an ox gores a male or female slave, the owner shall pay to the slave owner 30 shekels of silver, and the ox will be destroyed. That's what an animal is worth, or a slave. On the first day of unleavened bread, the disciples came to Jesus saying, where do you want us to make the preparations for you to eat the Passover? And Jesus said, well, go into the city to a certain man and say to him, the teacher says, my time is near. There are two significant words for translated time. One is chronos, that means the time you measure by the clock, by the moon and the sun, whatever. And the other is kairos, which you've heard before, I bet. And that means the appropriate time. Nothing to do with the clock, but the right time. The time of grace or whatever. My time is near. Tell him that. I'll keep the Passover at your house. And Matthew adds to the text, with my disciples. I keep telling you that, but it's a theme that comes all the way through Matthew. He's very much about Christ with us. Emmanuel, right at the beginning, in the first scene, and in the last scene, I will be with you always to the end of the age. And then the curtain falls on the drama. So that's what this is. I'll keep the Passover with my disciples at your house. So the disciples did as Jesus directed them, and they prepared the Passover meal. Matthew, following the tradition, is giving this meal a Passover significance. But as I've already said, it's actually not a Passover meal because there's no Passover lamb. They haven't been slaughtered yet. When it was evening, Jesus reclined with the 12, and while they were eating, he said, truly I tell you, one of you will betray me. They became greatly distressed and began to say to him, one after the other, surely not I, Lord. And he answered, the one who dipped his hand into the bowl with me will betray me. The Son of Man goes, as it is written of him, but woe to that one. Again, Jesus, really sad. Woe is a sad word. It's alas, alas for that one. To whom the Son of Man is betrayed. It would have been better for that one not to have been born. Judas, who betrayed him, said, surely not I, Rabbi. And Jesus replied, they're your words. You've said so. And now we come to this Last Supper. While they were eating, Jesus took a loaf of bread, and after blessing, and blessing is that eulogeo, eulogy. I mentioned earlier it comes from it. It's exactly that word taken from the Greek. So a blessing is a eulogy. It's a words of praise and wonder and admiration and all of that. It's not a gesture like we're used to. It's blessing means saying how to God how wonderful you are. Jesus broke the bread, gave it to his disciples and said, "Take, eat. This is my body." That's quite beautiful, but actually it's even more beautiful. Aramaic doesn't have a word for body. It's too vague. They don't have words for abstract kind of generalizations. The word Jesus would have used would have been flesh, and that's how it's translated in John's Gospel. "This is my flesh given for the life of the world," John chapter 6, etc. So he's saying, really, take it, this is my flesh. Now, what's that mean? That means your flesh, which is that part of you that's vulnerable, that part of me that will corrupt, will go into dust and ashes, etc. It's not the bones, it's not the strength, it's not the vital, whatever, it's not the blood, of course, but it's the flesh. So Jesus is giving us his broken body, we might say. His, that part of him that's so much part of us, that he shares very deeply, the part that can be hurt. "Take it, this is my..." Now, in here, we're using Greek now, it's written in Greek, and body is the word, but body is not a very clear concept in the Greek New Testament, because behind it is the word flesh. Then he took a cup, and after giving thanks, and there's the Greek for giving thanks, eucharisteo, Eucharist, it's exactly, we just take the word in Eucharist, is thanksgiving, something that gives thanks. Giving thanks, he gave it to them and said, "Drink from it, all of you. This is my blood." It's not the blood stuff that's in your veins, of course. We're not talking about that. There's no physical miracle taking place here whereby wine becomes blood. That's absurd. It's not what they're saying. No, there's no physical or chemical change takes place. I'm speaking now theologically. What happens is, we're talking about what really is it. What we're trying to get to the substance of it. Just pardon me a minute. Say I was a priest in a sacristy, an altar boy who was new at it, came in and tugged me by the alb, and I'm trying to get organised, and he'd say, "What are they?" And I'd say, "Oh, that's some bread. It's a special kind of bread. You know, it's not..." I'd fumble around trying to explain to him what, because it doesn't look like bread and doesn't taste like bread, but it really is unleavened bread. So I could say that, and that'd be it, and he might be satisfied with my answer, or he might go and ask his parents who'd say it in a better way. But if he came up to me a bit confused after the consecration and tugged me by the thing and said, "What's that?" I couldn't say bread anymore, because yes, it's physically bread and chemically bread, yes, but no, it's not bread now, it's my flesh, it's the flesh of Jesus, it's his life given for us, it's not wine, and it's his blood, meaning his life, Jesus' life, poured out in love. So you've got to go to the cross and look at the pierced heart of Jesus, and then we understand. So it's the substance. There's a transubstantiation happened. The substance means the answer to the question, what is it? And bread is unsatisfactory now as an answer. No, this is a gift. This is a divine presence. This is a sacrament. This is Jesus' life poured out for each of us and for us, for the world. So it's actually very beautiful, obviously. This is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for the many. So we're right to say at the Mass, for many. Once again, we've got a problem of language here. The trouble in English is the word many can mean not all. So it's just many, but not everybody. Well, that's got nothing to do with this text or the theology of the church. The word for many, you may have heard of the Greek word hoi poloi. It means not a tiny group. Even if you said all, but all was only three, they all came to the cricket match. But there was only three of them, but they all came. So all doesn't give an idea of size, whereas the word many does. This is given for the multitude. This is given, as how the French translated in their Eucharistic prayer, multitude, it's actually for all from Jesus' point of view, but all, not all, but the multitude. Everybody in a big, big way. Sorry, I'll come back to the text. It's poured out for the many, for the multitude, not for just a little coterie of disciples and not just for Jews. This is actually a gift for the world. And please God, everyone will take it up, in which case all is a good word. Now, Matthew's the only one who puts this in, and it's very beautiful. Why does it pour out? For the forgiveness of sin. Forgive is a lovely word in English. If you just look at the English there in front of you, it obviously comes from the word give. And the F-O-R can have a lot of different nuances through the English language. So I don't want to make it too simple. But basically, forgive means to give and keep giving. To forgive, to keep, to give and give and give and give. The way God is, who keeps giving. Giving his rain and his son to the multitude, to the world. It's the forgiveness of sins, and sins, as we've seen before already, right from the beginning, is missing the mark, is heading in the wrong direction. So I acquire a habit that's destructive of me and of you, and habits can be built up quite quietly almost. We don't notice it. We do it once and we do it twice, and then we end up being a very selfish person, or a very stubborn person, or a very envious person, or a very whatever. We acquire it habit bit by bit, and it becomes a habit. Habits are hard to break because they've been slowly built up, layer upon layer of behaviour. The hardest thing, if I've acquired a bad habit, is the first time I don't give in to it. That's the hardest step. Because if I resist the habit once, then the next time it's a tiny bit easier, and then gradually we can replace a bad habit with a good habit. Well, Jesus is giving his life for us, poured out from his heart, from the pierced heart of Jesus, John has it, to give us the love we need to change our behaviour. We can't do it without, only love makes possible that energy to break a habit or to embrace a new way of living or to take seriously the gospel or anything at all there. But we need love to do that, because without love we can't do it. Jesus is giving all his love here for us. I tell you, I'll never again drink of the fruit of the vine until that day when I drink it new with you. Here's the with again. In my Father's kingdom. Jesus is with his friends for a final meal. They're remembering God's redeeming action when God freed his people from slavery in Egypt and led them across the wilderness to the promised land. Jesus knows that his mission from God is to so love the world that everyone will be moved to leave behind whatever is enslaving their souls and journey with him into his Father's embrace. There's no paschal lamb at this meal, for it is Jesus himself whose life is about to be brutally taken from him by those who are determined to resist the freedom into which his love is calling them. It is his body that is about to be broken. It's his blood that is about to be poured out. He wants his disciples to know that while he's about to become the victim of the malice of his enemies, he knows his Father's love, and he entrusts himself into his Father's hands as he prepares to make of his death a final gift of himself to the world in love. Every day he'd been doing that. Well, he's going to continue doing it. We could easily see him as a victim of other people's sin, killing an innocent person, etc. But the Gospels, yeah, that's true, but they want us to look at all everything from the point of view of Jesus. How did he die? What did he do when he was treated so badly? How did he respond? As we begin our journey through Matthew's passion narrative, let us remember that throughout his sufferings, his heart is filled with love for each of us. He's consoled to see us journeying with him to Calvary and to the resurrection. When they'd sung the hymn, the text goes on, they went out to the Mount of Olives. Then Jesus said to them, "You'll all be scandalized because of me this night." Their ideas of who Jesus is are going to be shattered because they're expecting, they've still got this Messiah thing in their heads. Judas, more than anybody, Judas must have been a real leader. Obviously, Jesus didn't choose him for any other reason except that he was going to be a beautiful leader. But he didn't get the message. He thought, this is how I understand it. Judas brought on the confrontation between Jesus and Rome because he knew Jesus would win, meaning he'd then kind of do what he was supposed to be doing. So he's trying to hurry Jesus on to carry out Jesus' mission as he saw it, as he misunderstood it. Well, they've all got a bit of this misunderstanding going on. You'll all be scandalized because of me this night. They're going to see power differently and so on. For it's written, I'll strike the shepherd and the sheep will be scattered. But after I'm raised up, I'll go ahead of you to Galilee. And Peter said to him, they'll all become deserters because of you. I'll never desert you. Beautiful. And Jesus said to him, oh, Peter, truly I tell you, this very night, before the cock crows, you'll have denied me three times. You'll have persisted in denying me. Peter can't believe it. And all the disciples agreed. Then Jesus went, and again Matthew, with them. The Jesus of Matthew's gospel is very with you and with me and with us. He went to a place called Gethsemane. said to his disciples, "Sit here while I go over there and pray." And he took with him Peter and the two sons of Zebedee, and he began to be grieved and agitated. The scholars tell me that the Greek word there used for agitate is a very, very strong word. You could say he had a breakdown. He said to them, "I'm deeply grieved." And I'll be suggesting to you some perhaps reasons for his grief in a moment. "I'm deeply grieved even to death. Remain here. Stay awake with me." He needs you as much as you need him. So he needs the disciples, of course, because he's like us in everything. Going a little further, so now he's on his own, but with these close disciples close by, he threw himself on the ground and prayed, "Father, Abba, if it's possible, let this cup that he has to drink pass from me. But it's okay, I want to do what you want. Not my will, but yours be done. But if it's possible..." Then he came to the disciples and found them sleeping. And he said to Peter, "Oh, couldn't you stay awake with me even just an hour? Stay awake. Pray that you may not come into the time of trial." And that's what's in the Our Father. "Lead us not into temptation. Do not take us into the trial, because we're too weak to do it. So look after us, God. Don't let us be tested beyond our strength," etc. "The spirit is willing, yes, but the flesh is weak." And he went away for a second time and prayed, "Abba, if this cannot pass unless I drink it, your will be done." He wants God's will more than anything. "And again he came and found them sleeping, for their eyes were heavy. So leaving them again, he went away and prayed for a third time." In other words, he kept praying that night in the garden. "And he came to the disciples and said to them, 'Are you still sleeping and taking your rest? See, the hour is at hand. The Son of Man is betrayed into the hand of sinners. Get up. Let's go. My betrayer is at hand.'" And now just a few reflections. All his life, Jesus had wanted only to do the will of his Father. We know that. Now, because of the refusal of those in power to listen to God's revelation of love, Jesus' obedience is bringing him up against their sinful determination to have him killed. Jesus knows God's own revulsion of human cruelty and sin. God wouldn't want anything to do with this shocking behaviour of the leaders. Jesus knows God's own revulsion of human cruelty and sin. His heart reaches out to those he has not yet been able to reach during his all too short ministry. So, okay, he's cured some people, enlightened some people who are blind. He's helped some people like us who don't listen too well to listen. He's loved a leper and welcomed him back into his family. We've watched all these things that he's done. But it's pretty small, really. He's only been there for 2 or 3 years. It's not clear. It's a pretty short time. And there's the whole world needs what Jesus wants to give them. So he's asking, "God, give me some more time. I sat by the well with that woman of Samaria, but there's wells all over the place." In other words, I think Jesus is feeling that he's failed his mission. That's how I see it. It's a fair thing that He hasn't succeeded in doing his father's will the way he dreamed and the way he sensed his father wanted. And why? What's gone wrong? Is Jesus in that agony as he struggles? Is he saying, maybe I was too hard on the Pharisees? Maybe I shouldn't have not lost my temper, but I shouldn't have expressed my anger so in the temple. So maybe if I'd have, oh, I don't know what. I don't know what he's going on with. Of course, you know, I don't know. But that's what he's struggling with. A sense, I suggest, of perhaps failure. Certainly disappointment. And when he says, Father, not my will, but yours be done, it's very heroic, really. He's kind of asking to be able to embrace lepers a bit more, but maybe God, I don't know, I want to do your will before anything. And he comes up with that after that constant prayer with strength that takes him through the passion. And the strength is he's going to continue doing his father's will, which he knows really clearly. And it doesn't mean, as I think I was taught, or maybe you were taught to, it doesn't mean God's will was for Jesus to go and get crucified. I mean, that's pathetically hopeless. Think about it. What kind of a God are we talking about? No, Jesus saw he would continue to do his father's will, come what may, and no matter what other people might do to him. He'll continue embracing lepers. That's what he's saying to God. I'll continue to speak the truth in love. I'll continue to confront the authorities for what they're doing. Now he can see what they're planning and what they're probably going to succeed in doing, but that's not the point. He is going to do God's will. And he knows what it is, and he's going to continue. If it fails, if the authorities succeed, if he gets crucified, etc., well, in a sense, so be it. Somehow God will have to carry out God's will another way. Well, that's how I imagine it. His whole being trembles at the meaninglessness of what he's about to endure. What looks probable anyhow. God seems silent in this lonely garden, where the cold light of the full moon is filtered by the leaves of the ancient olive trees. God has asked Jesus to love, to give his life in love. So that's what Jesus is resolved to do, whatever the outcome for himself. His soul finds peace in this trust, and he rises to face the kiss of betrayal from the one he still calls friend. We'll see that. They're drawing near, the dark lit by the menacing torches of the temple guard. While Jesus was still speaking, Judas, one of the 12, arrived, and with him was a large crowd with swords and clubs from the chief priests and elders of the people. These are all Jewish guards of the temple. Wait for John's Gospel. John's Gospel has a whole cohort of Roman soldiers there too. So look at the drama. They're saying different things, good things, but different things. So here we've got a small scene, really. The betrayer had given them a sign saying, the one I'll kiss, that's the one. At once he came up to Jesus. Greetings, Rabbi, he said, knowing that Jesus is going to wake up at last and confront these people and win, because he's the Messiah. Greetings, and he kisses him. Jesus says to him, friend, do what you have to do. They came, they laid hands on Jesus and arrested him. No one was more bewildered than Judas at that. Suddenly one of those with Jesus put his hand to his sword, drew it out and struck the slave of the high priest, cutting off his ear. As the story, so no doubt that happened, something like that. They're doing their best, whatever they can do in the garden. But it's lovely the way the story, after a while we find it's his right ear that was cut off. And in the next gospel, his name is given to us as well, Malchus. So the story takes on a life of its own, but it's based on this attempt to be on Jesus' side by somebody. Jesus said to them, "No, this is not what it's about. Put your sword back into its place. All who take up the sword will live by the sword. Do you think that I can't appeal to my Father and he'll at once send more than 12 legions, 70,000 angels? How then would the scriptures be fulfilled which say that it must happen in this way?" Here's Matthew trying to get to understand the meaning of what's going on. At that hour, Jesus said to the crowds, "Have you come out with swords and clubs to arrest me as though I was a bandit? Day after day I sat in the temple teaching and you didn't arrest me. But all this has taken place." This is Matthew writing. He's always looking back for texts in the scripture that back up what's going on to help his Jewish friends read their scriptures again more carefully and see Jesus as the fulfillment of their poetry and dreams and so on. The disciples deserted Jesus and fled. Now I'll move a bit more quickly, if I may. Those who had arrested Jesus took him to Caiaphas, the high priest, in whose house the scribes and elders had gathered. Peter was following Jesus at a distance, as far as the courtyard of the high priest. And going inside, he sat with the guards to see how this would end. Now, the chief priests and the whole council, the Sanhedrin, the highest court, the Romans ran the country, but they left internal affairs to Judaism, to this Sanhedrin. They were looking for false testimony against Jesus so that they might put him to death, but they couldn't find any. Many false witnesses came forward, but according to their law, you had to have two or three for the case to stand. At last, two came forward and said, "This fellow said, I'm able to destroy the temple of God and build it in 3 days. The high priest stood up and said, "Have you no answer? What is it that they testify against you?" Jesus was silent. Then the high priest said to him, "I put you under an oath before the living God. Tell us if you are the Messiah." The Son of God is another term for Messiah. Jesus said to him, "They're your words. You've said so, but I tell you, from now on you'll see the Son of Man." Messiah, yes, if you understand Messiah probably, but Son of Man, the one who demonstrates God's judgment, seated at the right hand of the power, coming in the clouds of heaven. A reference back to the book of Daniel. The high priest tore his clothes and said, "He's blasphemed. Why do you still need witnesses? You have now heard his blasphemy. What is your verdict?" And they break their own law, of course, which people who stick by the law, it's amazing how often it's only when it suits them that they stick to the law, and when it gets in the road, they find a way around it. Well, we can do that. "You've heard his blasphemy. What's your verdict?" And they said, "He deserves death." Just a comment. Jesus is the Son of God, yes, but in a way beyond the comprehension of the Jewish leaders. He calls himself the Son of Man. He stands there in solidarity with all the ordinary people who down through the ages have been unjustly condemned by the powerful. God hears the cry of the poor, and Jesus has embraced their cause. There's a terrible irony in this scene, as in the scene before Pilate. The high priest and the other members of the Jewish court think they are judging Jesus. In reality, they stand condemned by the way they are abusing their power. They spat in his face, they struck him, some slapped him, saying, "Prophesy to us, you Messiah. Who struck you?" They're having fun. And then we come to Peter. Peter was sitting outside in the courtyard. A servant girl came to him and said, "You also were with him." With Jesus the Galilean. But Peter denied it before all of them, saying, "I don't know what you're talking about." And when he went out to the porch, another servant girl saw him and said to the bystanders, "This man was with Jesus of Nazareth." He denied it with an oath. Calls on God to witness the truth. "I don't know the man." And after a little while, the bystanders came up and said to Peter, "Certainly you're also one of them. Your accent betrays you." Then Peter began to curse and he swore an oath, "I don't know the man." At that moment, the cock crew. And Peter remembered what Jesus had said, "Before the cock crows, you'll deny me three times." And he went out and wept bitterly. Luke alone adds a very important piece that gives richness to this text. He has Jesus coming out from the court that he's been in, and he has Jesus looking at Peter across the courtyard, and Peter catches Jesus' eye, which gives a depth to this that Matthew hasn't got. It's the look of Jesus that causes Peter, well, the cock crowing, yes, but it's Jesus' glance that makes the difference. And what did his glance say? How do I know of it? But it's hurt, of course, sadness, but also forgiveness and love and encouragement. Must have been a beautiful look for Peter to, instead of despairing, which he could have done, he actually weeps. When morning came, all the chief priests and elders of the people conferred together against Jesus in order to bring about his death. They bound him, they led him away and handed him over to Pilate, the governor. They can do all this walking and etc. because this is not the Sabbath, this is not the Passover. Passover is the Saturday. This is all happening on the Friday. When Judas the betrayer saw that Jesus was condemned, he repented. He brought back the 30 pieces of silver because he realized what a fool he'd been. And he loves Jesus. He brings it back to the chief priests and elders and he said, "Look, I've sinned by betraying innocent blood." And they said, "Well, we're not interested in that. You look into it." So throwing down the pieces of silver in the temple, Judas departed and went and hanged himself. was what Judas did worse than what Peter did? We can't compare. It's not clear that it is. The difference between Peter and Judas, as he's remembered in the story here, is that Peter kept his eye on Jesus. Judas looked at himself and imploded because of what he'd done. Chief priests take the money and they buy a field, and I'll take that as read. Now Jesus stood before the governor, and the governor asked him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" And Jesus said, "You say so." He's not going to get caught up in all that. But when he was accused by the chief priests and elders, Jesus didn't answer. Pilate said to him, "Don't you hear how many accusations they make against you?" But Jesus gave him no answer, not even to a single charge, so that the governor was greatly amazed. Now at the festival, the governor was accustomed to release a prisoner for the crowd, anyone whom they wanted. We don't know about this practice from anywhere else except the Gospels, but it's not unlikely. At that time, they had a notorious prisoner called Jesus, Barabbas, interesting name, Jesus. Bar is son, Abbas is the father. Jesus, son of the father. There's a little something going on here. That was his name. So after they'd gathered, Pilate said to them, he's quite confident what they'll do, "Whom do you want me to release for you, Jesus, Barabbas, or Jesus the Messiah?" He realised that it was out of jealousy that they'd handed Jesus over. And another interesting, it's only in Matthew, while he was sitting on the judgment seat, his wife sent word to him, "Have nothing to do with that innocent man. Today I've suffered a great deal because I have a dream I had about him." And you know, Matthew, back in the prologue, Joseph's dreams. Dreams are something that Matthew and his community saw as a way, a possible way, of God bypassing our logic and getting to us. No doubt there's truth in that. Now the chief priests and elders persuaded the crowds to ask for Barabbas and have Jesus killed. The governor again said to them, "Well, which of the two do you want?" And they said, "Barabbas." And Pilate said, "Well, what do I do with Jesus, who's called the Messiah?" He's not buying into that. All of them said, "Let him be crucified." Then Pilate said, "Well, what's he done?" But they shouted all the more, "Let him be crucified." When Pilate saw that he could do nothing, but rather that a riot was beginning, he took some water, washed his hands before the crowd, saying, it's not as easy as this, but this is what he thought he could do, "I'm innocent of this man's blood. You see to it yourselves." He fails in authority to do what a governor should have done, because he's scared of what's the point, and he's got nothing to gain by or lose by Jesus being crucified. So his quick thing is, "I'll get rid of it, let the Jews solve it." All of the people answered, "His blood be on us and on our children. We'll take the blame for this, Pilate." So he released Barabbas for them, and after flogging Jesus, handed him over to be crucified. Then the soldiers of the governor, the high priest's guard, They've made fun of Jesus. Now the soldiers are going to have their turn. Soldiers of the governor took Jesus into the governor's headquarters and gathered the whole cohort around him. They stripped him, put a scarlet robe on him, and after twisting some thorns into a crown, they put it on his head and they put a reed on his right hand and knelt before him and mocked him, saying, "Hail, King of the Jews!" And they spat on him and took the reed and struck him on the head. And after mocking him, they stripped him of the robe and put his own clothes back on him. And they led him out to have him crucified. And a last comment. One doesn't take the cross upon oneself. We're not meant to seek the cross. Jesus didn't seek it. One doesn't take the cross upon oneself. It strikes from behind, catching you off balance. Is this your experience? Grasping for support that isn't there. So it was with Jesus. He, however, embraced the cross. And in so doing, he embraced those who thrust it upon him. He embraces us too in our folly, for his broken heart cannot stop loving us with all the love of the God who wants us to know that suffering need not destroy us. Accepted in love, it can purify our heart and open it more fully to grace. So I'll conclude there, and now just play a little bit of music that might pick up some of the themes. And you know there's no talk at 11:30 today, so you've got the rest of the day to depth this. A friend broken.
Before me.